199, the abandoned baby bill, and we've neglected the referral to Ways and Means. So Marilyn, would you chat with us about why it's not necessary to have that referral?
Yes, thank you, Chair Minnis. The Senate Bill 199 was amended, and the effect of those amendments was to alleviate the, or to deal with partly the fiscal that was attached to that. And as I understand it from the agencies, this will not reach the $50,000 threshold, so there would be no necessity of a referral to Ways and Means.
All right, so, trying to figure, do we need a suspension of the rules to reconsider the vote by which we cast out? Senator Courtney?
Suspend the rules for purposes of reconsidering the vote by which we pass Senate Bill 199 to the Senate floor.
All right, Senator Courtney moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsideration of the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 199 to the floor of the Senate. Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, rules are suspended.
Chair, I move that we consider the vote by which we pass Senate Bill 199 to the floor of the Senate.
Okay, Senator Courtney moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 199 to the floor of the Senate.
And this is not a, an amendment to the bill, we just...
No, we're just going to rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, no objection? Hearing none. So ordered, Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, I move that we remove the referral to the Senate Bill 199 to the Ways and Means Committee.
Senator Courtney moves that we remove the referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee for Senate Bill 199. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move that we, move Senate Bill 199 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves that Senate Bill 199 is amended by this committee to go to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Open public hearing then on Senate Bill...
Senator Minnis, is Senator Courtney going to be the carrier on that bill again?
I think, we usually assign carrier before, right?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Senate Bill 1370. Sorry about that. And we're going to start out, Diane Ray. And who?
Shelley Wacker.
Shelley Wacker. Bob Sundstrom?
Yeah.
And Scott Taylor, and Karen Brazell. Cadre of certified smart individuals. That's you.
Scott.
I'm making Diane.
Yeah, before you get started, I'm going to have council staff kind of go over a series of amendments that the committee has in front of them, so they know just generally why they're here and what they're intended to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. You'll note that we're going to take public hearing on Senate Bill 370, but before we do, I wanted to turn your attention, in your packet, you're going to note that there are a lot of prospective amendments to this bill. And what I did with the help of legislative council is put together six amendments to the Senate Bill 370. Now, the bill itself, Senate Bill 370, would repeal the sunset provisions that are in place on the legislation that the 1999 legislature passed regarding sex offender registration. If you look at your packets, ANOLA has given you amendments that, one through six. And without, just giving a thumbnail overview of those so that you can then listen, I think the panel's going to talk basically about where the law is currently. But I wanted you to, the dash one amendments would basically not repeal the sunset, but push out the sunset to 2004, which means that the 1999 legislation, which we currently have, would not be repealed until 2004. The dash two amendments would repeal those portions of the registration requirement that require a person to register if they've been convicted for a misdemeanor sex offense. And that would be sex abuse in the third degree, contributing to a sexual delinquency of a minor, and sexual misconduct. I will note that if you were convicted of attempted attempting a C felony, which under law would make that an A misdemeanor, there would still be a requirement to register under the Dash 2 amendments. Under the Dash 3 amendments...
Senator Bergen.
On this misdemeanor thing, does that include, it would repeal it for misdemeanors that were seated down?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it would be for purposes of the conviction. So in the case if there was a plea down to a sex abuse in the third degree, for example, under the Dash 2 amendments, there would not be a requirement to register. So when it's not in terms of what is charged by the district attorney in a charging offense, it's what's the conviction, which would be the state of things now, too, for example. Getting back to the thumbnail overview, the Dash 3 amendments is an amendment that deals with the Internet, would limit posting of information on the Internet only to predatory sex offenders or sexually violent and dangerous offenders. So, as you know or may not know, currently all people who have been convicted of a sex offense register, but this would amendment would make posting of the Internet only for those two classifications, predatory sex offenders and sexually violent and dangerous offenders. So that would limit which postings would be on the Internet. The Dash 4 amendments basically retain the changes made in 1999 with an exception that a juvenile convicted, or actually the term is adjudicated in juvenile court, would not be required to register unless a juvenile court found a substantial probability the youth would commit sex crimes in the future. The Dash 5 amendment is an amendment that I ask legislative counsel to amend Senate Bill 370 so that the Oregon law would mirror the federal requirements, so that Oregon would be meeting the federal requirements but would have nothing in addition to what's required federally to have the federal monies for registration. And lastly, the Dash 6 amendments simply is a directive that there be an interim committee to work on one aspect of juvenile, one aspect specifically of juvenile sexual offending, and working on tools to measure recidivism. And I think that the committee or the panel here will be able to talk perhaps about where that stands currently, what tools we have to measure recidivism with juvenile sex offenders.
All right. And who's starting?
I will, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Ray, and I'm the chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And at your request, we have prepared a brief presentation to orient the committee on registration, notification, and supervision of adult and juvenile sex offenders in Oregon. Senate Bill 370, which is the bill we are here on today, and its predecessor 740, include provisions that in some way touch on each of these concepts. We've prepared a graph, which I believe has been passed around to you, that lays out separately notification, registration, and supervision, and then it has categories for adult and juvenile. And we laid it out this way, hoping that you'd be able to see just real briefly what the provisions are in Oregon for each of these concepts as it relates to adults and juveniles. And I just wanted to walk through this with you real briefly. There's other folks here at the table who have more expertise in some of these areas, obviously, than I do, but I want to at least introduce the graph to you and hope that it gives you a good overview and helps you sort out the issues relating to Senate Bill 370. When we say adults, we're referring to adult offenders and juveniles convicted as adults. That would be ballot measure 11 juveniles and juveniles waived into adult court. And for the category of juveniles, that's just true juveniles adjudicated only in juvenile court. In the first section, we've laid out registration, and we've identified some of the agencies that are connected with the act of registration in Oregon. We've also attached the statutes that relate to it, and basically, as Mr. Prinz indicated, virtually all offenders convicted of a sex crime, and that's a real broad range of a list of crimes that's in statute, are required to register, and they're required to do it within a certain number of days of release or when they move from a certain residence. and it allows the public upon request to receive certain information about the offender. For adults on supervision, the public may receive upon request the offender's name, date of birth, physical description, the nature of the crime, a photograph, and the parole officer's name. When the offender goes off of supervision at the end of the post-prison supervision period, virtually the same information is available, but the public may also receive the exact address of the offender. When you move over to the box relating to registration for juveniles, you see much of the same information. It's indicated that all bulleted items regarding adults are the same as for juveniles, and we've also indicated there the information available to the public upon request, and it is quite similar to that available for adults. Under the notification section, we've laid out the numbers for the statutes for that, and it's a different concept than registration in several respects. Number one, while all sex offenders must register, there is not notification for all sex offenders. The notification statute says that there will be notification for offenders deemed predatory, and it places with the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision the job of identifying which are predatory. And it says that we must do that by using a tool approved by the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections, and we do that. We use a risk assessment tool, and we identify certain offenders as, quote, predatory. And what that does is it allows community corrections, then, each parole officer to develop a notification plan suitable for the case and for their community and determine the scope of notification. So while those offenders who are being notified on will also be registering, the reverse is not always true. Not everyone registering is going through this notification plan and process. At the end of post-prison supervision, when there's no longer a parole officer to be in charge of that notification plan, the responsibility for notification then shifts to the Oregon State Police. For notification for juveniles, the box relating to juveniles and notification, indicates that the scheme that I just described applies to juvenile sex offenders determined to be predatory and no longer under supervision, so that notification occurs after supervision, where with the adults, notification occurs during supervision and after. And it's indicated that the Department of State Police Chief of Police, after consulting with the person's last primary supervising agency, determines if the juvenile is a predatory sex offender, and the State Police historically has been using the same tool that the Board of Parole has been using to try to do that. The notification itself is carried out by the local police or Department of State Police if the juvenile is found to be predatory. The third separate concept that you have going on with this bill relates to supervision, and I neglected to write probation. I should have. I focus on post-prison supervision because that's part of our work, but supervision relates to adult offenders or juvenile offenders placed on parole or probation or post-prison supervision. Probation is imposed by the court, and post-prison supervision is following a term of incarceration. The Board of Parole is responsible for adult offenders placed on post-prison supervision, and they're on a period of supervision that's ordered by the court. As soon as that term ends, offenders are no longer on supervision, and the board cannot enforce any conditions against that person. There is a provision for lifetime post-prison supervision, but that's only for a relatively narrow group of offenders that have been identified as, quote, sexually violent dangerous offenders, and that's set out in ORS 137.765, and for those offenders, the court must find them to be sexually violent dangerous offenders and order lifetime post-prison supervision. That's a statute that was passed last session, and so far I'm unaware of any cases in which a court has done that. It's, like I said, a pretty narrow group of offenders, but I'm unaware of any people that we currently have on lifetime post-prison supervision pursuant to that statute. Finally, the last box you have there is supervision that relates to juveniles. And it indicates that the County Juvenile Department or Oregon Youth Authority supervise the juvenile sex offender for the length of time ordered by the court. And like adults, when the supervision period time is over, the supervision ends. And the sexually violent dangerous offender statute, the lifetime post-prison supervision that I just mentioned to you, does not apply to juveniles because that statute specifically says it can only be applied to people that were 18 or older when they committed their crime. So that's effort to oversimplify a rather complex set of laws, and we hope that's helpful to you. And obviously, if there's questions, we'd be glad to help you with that.
Senator Burdick. Mr.
Chairman, what is the status of the Internet posting project? When is that supposed to get online?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Sundstrom. I'm a lieutenant with the state police and I manage the violent offender section. The sex offender registration unit falls within my section. And with me today is Shelley Wacker, the manager of the sex offender registration unit. The current status is it's presently in the Court of Appeals, so we have not gone online with the Internet. And it's a position of our superintendent that we will not use the Internet for posting of general information to the public on registered sex offenders unless there's something designated in law to do so.
The provision in the dash, I'm probably getting ahead of myself, you can stop me if you want. The dash 3, I think it was, is that the kind of statutory?
Oh, you're ahead of yourself.
You're not the chairman. is the information, is the provision in the dash 3 amendments limiting the posting on the Internet to violent and dangerous offenders and sexual predators, is that the kind of authority that he's looking for to do it?
That would be correct, ma'am.
Thank you.
All right. Let me see. One of the other issues we're going to be discussing in depth is the issue that's been alluded to, and I want to make sure the committee understands this. Under current law, when a juvenile is convicted of one of these sex crimes, then they are required to register for life. Is that correct? Register for life. Right. An existing law. Am I wrong? Am I right? Okay, you guys can assert yourselves a little bit. This is kind of a conversation between us, but I'll make sure that everybody understands that. And so part of the discussion that we're going to get into is the issue of whether or not certain juvenile offenders should be registered, and we're going to hopefully have some discussion about some of the differences that exist between some juveniles and others as it relates to their predisposition for committing future crimes, and also some of the difficulties that have come to our attention in some of the discussions that I've had with the department and various people, that we lack a significantly sound or reliable instrument to determine the predatory nature of a juvenile sex offender, which gets us into an even broader and deeper and somewhat more ethereal discussion about the efficacy of various research going on relevant to the intervention in the lives of young persons who are accused of sex offenses and whether or not they can or cannot, I guess, benefit from certain kinds of therapies and so on and so forth. So anyway, I want to highlight that for the committee, that that's an issue that we're going to discuss because the amendments, there are amendments here that would basically ratchet that back and register only those juveniles that the judge would mandate them to be registered, predicated upon a certain set of facts and circumstances and case history, and that's kind of got lots of different ideas about how that should or shouldn't happen. So, all right?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, on your desk, and we will get to it later in our presentation, but buried somewhere in your desk is a little booklet like this that speaks specifically to juvenile sex offender issues, and behind some of the tabs is some information about the juvenile sex offenders and the youth authority's custody and the ages and kinds of crimes they've committed. And with regard to the chart that Diane just reviewed for you, I think what's compelling about the juvenile sex offender side of it is how remarkably similar it is to the adult offender side.
Mr. Chair, say that again.
There's very little difference between how the two are treated.
How adult offenders are treated versus how juvenile. And that gets us to another discussion because research tells us, by and large, that when you get to the adult level, the ability, although there are therapists who would tell you that there are therapeutic strategies that work to help stabilize certain individuals who are sex offenders in adult categories, the research is much more clear as it applies to juveniles that certain kinds of intervention work. So, okay.
Not my turn.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I am really having trouble hearing people.
Are you?
Is it, I mean...
I think maybe it's the positioning of the microphone.
Maybe it's just that I'm the oldest member up here. I don't know. But anyhow...
Yeah, we're not going there.
You're having a hard time hearing also? Okay.
Fan is on or something?
Okay, so is that it?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might, one proposal that we had to work through this hearing would be to give you the overview, which we did. We can offer to you now some information about federal law and the Jacob Wetterling Act and how we ended up with 740, and Bob and Shelley can do that. And then we thought we could talk to you a little bit about some of the issues on the sort of the adult side, so to speak, of 370, then the juvenile side of 370, and then some budget issues that I think you were concerned about. So that's a format that we're willing to do if that would help the committee.
Yes, absolutely. And let's just be frank here as we're discussing, too, because if she gets to the budget issue, you're going to find that there's a substantial hole in the state police budget for the purpose of sex offender registration. And I'll probably speak out on its vicarious implications on local police departments also. So, whoever, go ahead.
Right. Chairman Menace and members of the committee, my name again is Shelley Wacker, and I'm the Sex Offender Registration Unit Program Manager for the Oregon State Police. Again, with me is Lieutenant Robert Sundstrom, who is the manager of the Violent Offender Section, which includes the Sex Offender Registration Unit. And what we put together for you today hopefully will be helpful in making a comparison between federal law and Oregon's current law. We ran down the list and tried to categorize it into different sections to help you make a better comparison of the federal laws with current law. I'd like to just briefly run through the document with you if I could and point out some of the highlights if possible. The first section deals with lifetime or registration requirement for lifetime registration with the federal law if an offender is convicted of an aggravated offense or they're a recidivist. The federal requirement then goes on to say that states should have a minimum of 10-year registration for those offenders that were not convicted of aggravated offenses or a recidivist. Now, first of all, in the comments section, we've put a definition of the aggravated offenses and a comparison with Oregon law, which covers both of these areas of the federal law by requiring all offenders to register for lifetime. And those offenders that have been convicted of one C felony or less can seek relief through the court 10 years after their supervision is completed. The next area covers lifetime registration for juveniles, which currently is not federally required at all that juveniles register. And in the state of Oregon, we do require lifetime registration for juveniles. And again, as the adults, they have the ability to seek relief from that registration 10 years after supervision if their crime of conviction was one C felony or less. The next section talks about the registration data and frequency. And again, federal law requires that sex offenders register a change of address when they move, and also that they complete a registration form annually within 10 days of their birth date. Again, Oregon law goes towards the federal mandates and also requires offenders to register a change of address within 10 days of moving and complete a registration form annually. Federal law addresses the sex offender trafficking procedures, and again, Oregon covers that through the centralized record or central repository that was created through the state police through Senate Bill 740 that was passed in 99. The next part of the document deals with interstate movement of sex offenders, and basically it requires sex offenders who are convicted in other states and move into the state of Oregon to complete the registration requirements in the state of Oregon. We do that based on an offender moving to Oregon after 1995 and also if an offender is required to register in the state that they're coming from.
Senator Duncan.
Quick question then. If one was convicted of a sex offense in a state that did not require registration and they moved to Oregon, and weren't even aware. Are they required, they're required to register here? How would they know that?
Chairman Minnis and Senator Duncan, it would depend on their date of relocation. If they relocated to Oregon prior to September 1st of 1995, they would not be required to register in the state of Oregon. It's those offenders who relocate after that date of 95 that are required to register in Oregon.
Okay. I guess my question, Mr. Chair, is, it seems to be conceivable that one might not even know they had to register in the state. I just wonder how that works. Shelley?
Chair Minnis and Senator Duncan, I guess it is conceivable. We do have procedures set up where each state notifies other states when an offender is moving. Now, if this offender is not registered in the state they're coming from, you're right. Conceivably, that offender could move to the state of Oregon, and we would not know of his whereabouts.
And, Mr. Chair, it's possible that he might not or she might not know they were supposed to register.
Correct.
And they still would be in violation.
Okay. That's correct.
Technically, they'd be in violation, but it would not be a case that could be prosecuted. Would not be a case that could be prosecuted because the defendant wouldn't have any knowledge of their requirement.
Right. Until the offender was informed of their obligations to require or that are required in the state of Oregon.
You don't have any announcements that say people who are sex offenders must register in Oregon.
No.
Better call that sound guy.
Okay. Is that too loud?
No, I think you just need, maybe they need to turn it down a little bit. We just need to remember to speak up.
Okay. The next section addresses offenders who come from another state to work in the state of Oregon and also addresses students that live in other states and come into Oregon to attend school. Now, currently, the federal law is that if a worker comes into Oregon and they work 14 consecutive days or 30 accumulative days a year, they're required to register in the state they work. Currently, Oregon law is that if a person comes in and works 14 days a year, whether those are accumulative or consecutive, they're required to register in the state of Oregon. Current Oregon law also requires a student coming in to attend school that they register within 10 days of their first day of attendance at school. The address verification federal law again requires that periodically sex offender addresses are verified. For those offenders under supervision, the predatory offenders, those addresses are verified every 90 days by the supervising official. For offenders off of supervision, that's handled through procedure and that's done through sex offender sweeps.
Now, tell us, who does those sex offender sweeps?
Chairman Minnis, it's actually a good collaborative effort between the state police and a lot of local law enforcement agencies that generally put it together for a particular county in the state to accomplish the sweep.
Multnomah County, who would that normally be?
Portland Police Bureau.
I only know because I'm alluding to the fact that we do these on a regular basis. But yes. Tell me about participation by other police agencies.
As far as the sweeps?
Well, it's been told to me that some agencies choose not to participate in these kind of things and that they opt out of it. And other agencies like Portland end up getting stuck with the bill for doing this.
I think that's probably a true statement. What we've noticed is that we have much more effort and cooperation with different law enforcement agencies with the law enforcement website that has gone up and become available over the last year to law enforcement across the state. And the reason I refer to that is through that website system, they can bring up non-compliance lists for just their particular city, county, or area. And a lot of the agencies choose to do their sex offender sweep based off of those non-compliance lists that they can bring up through the website.
Okay. Maybe we could get some legislators to go on a sex offender sweep. Very interesting. That actually is interesting.
Yes. The next section of the comparison involves the information to the public. Federally, again, it's the release of registration information for public safety, and also that the identity of victims and victims' information is not released. Currently, in Oregon law, we release sex offender information upon request from the public and do not release any victim or victim information. The next section covers the sexually violent and dangerous offender in Oregon, and federal law requires that a state has a procedure or a determination board as far as determining which offenders are sexually violent and dangerous. For the state of Oregon, it's the courts that make that determination of a sexually violent and dangerous offender. Those offenders, again, are under lifetime supervision, and so therefore their addresses would be verified on a 90-day basis.
Just again, I want to kind of interject here. If I recall correctly, and somebody out there can correct me if I'm wrong, but the 1999 legislature enacted the lifetime parole or probation or supervision, whatever it's called, kind of as a response to State versus Hendricks out of Kansas that came down in 1997, that in Kansas they were using a civil commitment procedure post-incarceration, where persons deemed to be sexually violent offenders were actually incarcerated, and the United States Supreme Court upheld the action by the state of Kansas, but required that there be some therapeutic kind of environment for these persons who were held in civil commitment post-prison, and also required that they be adjudicated in some form to be a sexually violent offender. Now, some of us back in 1997 traveled up to the state of Washington to McNeil Island Penitentiary, for the state of Washington likewise chose to have a civil commitment procedure for individuals who were deemed to be sexually violent offenders. And kind of as an aside, the physician who was overseeing that program was asking us if there were any jobs in Oregon because he wanted out so badly, and basically explained that some of these folks that are incarcerated there in that civil commitment procedure are so high on a psychopathy scale that they're virtually untreatable. So the dilemma that Washington has is they have persons incarcerated in the civil commitment environment who they have no basis to believe that any of the known therapies will actually work or have any value to them. So Oregon has chosen a different route, and that is to try to supervise as best possible. So that's kind of why we're here.
Okay. The next section deals with information sharing and national sex offender registration. It addresses that information is available to law enforcement when an offender moves within the state. This is currently handled through procedure in Oregon with the Sex Offender Registration Unit broadcasting APBs through LEDs to all law enforcement in the county where the offender is residing. The next part addresses that information, registration information is transmitted promptly to law enforcement agencies, and that's covered through the three-day the requirement through 181-596, where registering agencies are required to forward that registration information within 3 days to the central repository. And then the participation in the National Sex Offender Registry. Again, in Senate Bill 740, it provides for LEDs to be able to transmit sex offender information nationally. The next section deals with crimes and whether Oregon's crimes meet the federal crime types. Again, Oregon registrable sex crimes meet the federal crimes. We have two crimes that are not federally mandated for registration. Those are burglary with the intent to commit a sex crime and public and private indecency. The federal law also requires for registration for a person convicted of kidnapping a youth under the age of 18. Currently, in Oregon's current law, we address kidnap with involving a youth under the age of 18, excluding parents and relatives. And finally, the penalties. The federal law, again, requires that states have penalties for sex offenders who do not comply with the sex offender registration requirements in their state. And again, current Oregon law does have penalties for noncompliance with registration. So that kind of concludes the breakdown between the current Oregon state laws and the federal laws. Be happy to answer any more questions anyone might have.
How many registered sex offenders do we currently have in Oregon?
Just a little over 9,500. I think it was 9,527.
9,527. Now, individuals who are incarcerated, not previously registered, are they not registered inside the institution?
No. and they're not reflected in that number.
So do we have any idea how many sex offenders are currently incarcerated who would otherwise be required to register?
I don't know that number.
Somebody did.
Maybe.
One-third of the inmate population incarcerated in Oregon is incarcerated for sex crimes.
And you are?
Darcy Baker, Clackamas County Community Correction.
All right. And we currently have a little over 10,000 inmates in the state penitentiary system, so that would roughly be 3,500.
One-third.
All right, and then one additional question. With the 9,500 registered sex offenders, how many of those are juveniles, not Measure 11?
In our system, we currently have right at 1,800 juveniles that are no longer under supervision, and we have a little over 400 that are currently on supervision.
All right, and how many people do you have in the Department of State Police that are assigned to the responsibility of overseeing this program?
As far as the data entry and the processing of registrations.
Right, people that have anything to do with sex offender
registration. Currently, there's about a total of 7 people that have some involvement with the program.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm afraid we're going to know more about sex offenders and sex offender registration than we ever wanted to know.
We're already there.
All right. And this is the scaled down presentation, too.
Good afternoon. I'm Scott Taylor, Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections here on 370. Before we go on with the presentation, I'll talk more about adult sex offenders.
Can you speak up just a bit?
Yeah. Yes. I wanted to respond briefly when Darcy talked about one-third of the population and the institutions being sex offenders. I noticed the concern or the questioning around that. I want to keep in mind that one of the reasons that occurs is because of Measure 11 and the length of time that people are now spending. They begin to stack up. There's when people first hear that number, there's an assumption that we have had a massive increase in sex offender. The population growth as they come in the door is remaining fairly constant, but because they can't go back out the door under Measure 11, we begin to accumulate a much larger sex offender population. I just wanted to offer that as a, how they compare with the rest of the population.
Does it get to be 100%?
To keep in mind, our total population on supervision, we have 10,000 in the community, 10,000 in prison, and we have about 30,000 offenders under supervision in the community. So the 9,000 gives you an idea of that total pop of the community population, how many are sex offenders.
Okay.
We think we'd like to start with Darcy Baker.
My name is Darcy Baker, and I supervise the Sex Offender Domestic Violence Unit for Clackamas County Community Corrections, and I'm here today to support Senate Bill 370. When Senate Bill 740 went into effect, it created one uniform system for sex offender registration. Prior to its enactment, parole and probation officers were responsible for registering those offenders on supervision. Once supervision ended, it became the offender's responsibility to register with local law enforcement. This was a very cumbersome system, causing a great deal of confusion. Since Senate Bill 740 went into effect, the registration responsibility has become the offender's. They know from the onset of supervision what the registration requirements are. The requirements are the same, whether they are on or off supervision, thus ending a great deal of confusion. And since going to one registration system, we've seen a reduction in the number of non-compliant cases. Senate Bill 740 also created a database of registered sex offenders, which is available upon request to all law enforcement agencies, including parole and probation and district attorney's offices. As an agency with access to that database, I can tell you that it has been an invaluable tool for us. We can check to see if our offenders are current with their registration requirements.
Plus, we can track the number of sex offenders both on and off supervision in any given zip code. And this is valuable for us as we are planning resources in the community when we're going and making presentations at community meetings, talking about the number of sex offenders that are living in any community and what the realities are of sex offenders in your neighborhood. Senate Bill 740 expanded the list of registration crimes to include public or private indecency, provided the offender had a previous conviction for a sex crime. Recognition of this crime category for registration has been long overdue. Exposing crimes are viewed as gateway crimes. While not every exposer will go on to rape, most rapists have some type of exposing crime in their history. This is a population of offenders that is difficult to treat, and we find that they have a significant number of victims, most of all of whom have not been reported. So this was a real benefit to have this population of offenders have to register. Should Senate Bill 370 pass, it will repeal the sunset, and we will be able to retain all of these gains that we have made. And so I would urge you to pass 370, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
How do you feel about the amendment to limit the posting on the internet to violent and dangerous offenders and sexual predators?
I think that is a good idea. I think that would be the smart way to go. One of the things that we are constantly saying when we're going to community meetings is trying to educate the public that not every sex offender is the same. Not every sex offender poses the same risk to you and your family. And I think it would be wise to limit that tool to those that we have the greatest concern about.
Another question, Mr. Chairman. One of the issues about anybody convicted of an offense is whether or not they can buy firearms or get a concealed handgun license. What is the current requirement on people with sex offenses? It's probably more a question for state police, but what limitations are there?
Senator Burdick, Darcy Baker might be a little better at answering that. I am not familiar with what the restrictions are as far as firearms for certain registered sex crimes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe it would just go back to the felony, no possessing of firearms. Of course, someone who's on probation can have special conditions of probation, but as I recall, I don't recall anything that is tied into registration that would prohibit someone from possessing firearms. Keep in mind that there are only 3 to 4 of these that are misdemeanors. So for the vast majority of what is called sex offenses, those are felonies, and the person would definitely not be able to legally possess a firearm.
Provided their firearms rights have not been restored to them. There is a caveat in the law that says you can go back to the judge that convicted you and request to have your firearms rights restored. What I always tell my offenders is I've never met an offender yet who's had their firearms rights restored. They tell me that it can happen. I've yet to see it happen.
Mr. Chair, that's after they've completed their probation. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
So once you're convicted of felony, you've lost that right for life, right?
That's correct. And
No. Not the firearm.
Once you've been convicted of felony, you cannot legally possess a firearm.
Even after you've completed your probation?
If your firearms rights have been restored.
With concealed handgun licenses, you can get a concealed handgun license 15 years after you've been convicted of a felony.
Mr. Chairman, I think the issue is if you go back and ask them and get a judge to sign off, which has never happened as far as Ms. Baker knows, if you get someone to sign off and say, okay, now can I get my right to have a firearm back if I've been convicted of a felony? If you did that,
I believe that's not. I've just recently been looking into the concealed handgun license issue, and what I was told is that 15 years after conviction of a felony, you can get a concealed handgun license. So I assumed that you could also get a gun.
That's an assumption.
I would.
Next person to go. Who's the next presenter, please?
Scott Taylor with the Department of Corrections, and I'll be brief. We support Senate Bill 7370 also. Since we've started this, as Darcy talked about, the ability to manage this population more effectively has increased. We do have a few areas that we've worked with the state police over time as we've been implementing this project. Right now, we have about 1,250 predatory parole and post-prison supervision people on supervision. And I mention that because of what Darcy talked about. We haven't spent time today talking about our whole, the way we work through the tool, the refinement, the way we go out and do notification and the visitation and the polygraph and the overall management of the offender. So there's a group that we place in the predatory group that are the more risky, and those are the ones we notify on, go out and do more aggressive notification. One of the things that happens as we were looking at this is under the current law, as a person goes off supervision, they then transition to the state police to be on, basically on that management for the rest of their life. And what was happening was that the state police would have to rescore the individual to determine whether they should be registered or they were in fact predatory for the separation of the lists and the management of that and the notification that goes on. We would, and in the amendments that were presented, we did not have one of those as I listened to them be read. One of the things we were interested in was the ability to transition the scoring that has gone on over the period of supervision of that individual. So between the parole board and the supervising officer, we've determined whether the person should be predatory or not. And what we'd like to do is be able to hand that that level of certification to the state police and allow them to just take that without having to rescore the individual. So we'd like to be able to have the classification move across when supervision is ended. Other than that, with the adult management, we are pleased with the relationship we have right now.
Yes, please.
I don't have anything to add to that. Thank you.
Let me just make sure of something. The reference to the out of the 10,200 something like that, people are in prison, 3,000 are in for sex offenses. That's for primary, that's their primary crime. Is that correct, the 3,000? That's how you refer to it?
Chair Courtney, yes.
So that there could be some others that are in that have sex offenses in their background, but you don't show them as in the prison for sex offenses in that 3,000. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. You mentioned there's 1,200 today that are designated as predatory on some kind of supervision, is that right?
On post-prison supervision, post-prison or parole supervision.
Yeah, that are predatory.
Yes.
That you notice on. The thing is, you don't have to notice on any of them. The law doesn't require you to notice. That's not correct. You may notice, isn't that right?
Chair Courtney, when they become predatory, we have to develop a plan, a notification plan. So, yes, the degree of notification can go all the way down to, I would hate to say nothing, but next to nothing on up to.
Well, I thought it was in the parole board, the parole officer's jurisdiction that they make that decision. For example, if they tell a certain individual, you don't follow your treatment program, I'll notice on you, and they use it as an incentive to make sure the individual follows their treatment program.
That's correct. They can use it.
Right. So there could be actually no notice given in effect in terms of the neighborhood notice under certain circumstances of an individual who has a predatory designation.
That's correct.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They're basically, I think.
Were you through? All right. Is Diane to just say? Anybody's interested in all the screaming, it's a protest on bilingual education. Yes.
Is it in English?
No,
the
English and Spanish.
They get into the number of sex offenses, families who are in the county systems. I haven't got those numbers. When I did my bill in the House, how many juveniles? There's 1,500, about 10-15% of juveniles are in OYA. And then I got Spence, bus Spencer's here. It's all over the county. And you got county jails and the chiefs that come in. You get a magnitude of these sex.
Thank you. Okay. Now, Karen, you're going to talk a little bit more about some of the prospective changes, or are you going to talk about just the way it works now?
Potential changes.
Okay.
K, Karen Brazeau, Oregon Youth Authority, and with me today is Dr. Keith Kaufman, professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Portland State University, and he is also a member of the Oregon Youth Authority Advisory Committee. We're here specifically to talk about sex offender registration with regard to juvenile offenders, and a little bit of background about why we come to you today is that there's been recognition since Oregon passed laws governing juvenile sex offender registration that it's a little more complex. The issues around sex offender registration and sex offender treatment, a little more complex with juvenile offenders than with adult offenders. And there's been a number of work groups during the interim looking at some of the issues around juvenile sex offender registration, the designation of predatory or risk behaviors, and how it relates to Oregon laws. And you've heard from the state police that that Oregon, like all states, is not mandated through any federal regulation to register juvenile sex offenders at all. Or, to put it another way, federal money is not tied to the registration of juvenile sex offenders. Oregon has chosen to do so as a matter of policy. And if you remember back to Diane Ray's charts, how we treat Oregon juvenile offenders is not that much different from Oregon's adult sex offenders. And yet, in fact, the two populations are very different. Like Department of Corrections, they represent an increasingly high number of youth in the Oregon Youth Authority's custody. There are, in the green booklets that you have, there's some information if you sometime now or later want to look through it. I won't go through it with you. But in March, the end of March, we had 579 kids committed to the Youth Authority on sex offenses. It's getting to be an increasingly high proportion of the youth in our care are for sex offenses. We included some case examples. I put them in just as they come to us because they make for very interesting reading. You can see by the nature of those cases, we just selected a few, all the way from very serious offenses to young kids who've made some really bad choices and engaged in some misconduct, but by anyone's standards would not be viewed the same as a 45-year-old sexual predator, and yet current state law treats them exactly the same. The various work groups that have been struggling with these issues had been prepared to say it's too soon to make any changes because there is not a risk assessment tool to determine risk to reoffend in juvenile offenders does not exist in the country, and Dr. Kaufman can address that far better than I. I think that there is a division among members of those groups, all the way from some who believe that no juvenile offender should be registered to others who believe that the law as it currently stands, having all juvenile offenders be registered for lifetime, works just fine. What I'm about to propose as an in-between spot tries to, I think, capture what we want for any kind of public process that registers offenders is some way that provides more public safety. I don't believe the system that we have now in this very wide, we cast a very wide net in registering all juvenile sex offenders for life in the hopes that it will somehow protect the public from the few that we can't sort out yet who may pose some future risk. I don't think it's a process that goes very far in protecting public safety. It's also very expensive. Mr. Chair, you ask about the costs associated in staff time with the state police. It's also true that every one of the youth authorities, parole and probation officers, as well as the county officers, engage in the youth in the act of registration, and that means that we have to train them to do that. They have to work with the youth, every sex offender youth, to get the paperwork right, make sure the address change. I mean, it's not a huge task, but it's an ongoing piece of work, and
making sure that it gets done. So the, before I give Dr. Kaufman a minute to talk, I want to share with you the proposal, and then maybe Dr. Kaufman can share his views, and we can come back and talk more about the proposal. You have a handout in front of you, and it's up here on the board. What we're talking about is for new cases, those cases that involve force or compulsion would continue on as they do now under lifetime registration. We would like to revisit that again, and when we have a risk assessment that would allow us to, even with those, in those crimes, to determine which of those young people pose a future risk. And with all others, we would like for those youth to complete their treatment and supervision and go back before the judge, who would look at those youth and judge them through criteria of how did they do during their course of treatment. Did they participate in their treatment? Did they pass their polygraph? And what is their crime history? And the judge can make a determination on those criteria and determine whether that youth needs to be registered at all. And if not, there is no registration for the youth offender. Or could the district order the youth to be registered, at which time the youth would have to register, and if the youth remains of future sex crimes for 5 years, then would be removed from the sex offender registration. It left kind of leaves open what to do if 1,800 youth offenders who are currently on sex registration filed in the state police. And the proposal is to treat those youth exactly the same. Those who are there for acts involving force or compulsion assessment tool, and if they have been on supervision or off supervision for 5 years without a sex crime, then they would be dropped from the sex offender registration roll. And the reason this extends up to age 30 is that the time the juvenile offender can be on supervision up to age 25, and so it would give 5 years post-supervision. That's the proposal that we're making. It satisfies neither those who would like to see us completely move away from sex offender registration for juveniles completely, or those who would like to maintain the system as it is. What we're trying to establish is some kind of balance. We know what goes on now is the system is pretty onerous right now, and we know of several counties where low-level sex offenses are diverted to the dependency side, for example. So the sex offense doesn't even show up on the youth record at all because people want to avoid sex offender registration. Or the sex offense, the youth may go through treatment and then the whole order is vacated. So we're trying to come up with something that would create an honest and true record, show that the youth has been in treatment, and then have a judgment made later on the youth.
Okay. I want to give a little kind of another little dissertation here for those of us that have been here since 1989 and before. Some of this stuff started with Senator Joyce Cohen in the Senate and the creation of and kind of adding an additional component to this whole discussion, the creation of multidisciplinary teams in each of the 36 counties within the state of Oregon, and another component called the CAMI Fund, which is the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account, which we will be dealing with at some point because there is a budgetary proposal that will restructure the criminal fines and assessment account, which is otherwise known as unitary assessment, for a different purpose. But what you need to know is that there has been a transition in terms of enforcement and prosecution of sex offenders since 1989. and also that this kind of coincides with the restructuring of Children's Services Division to the State Office for Services to Children and Families. When the component of the CAMI fund monies were added to the multidisciplinary teams, and a number of large metropolitan police departments or district attorney's offices took the lead role, which they were designated to have by statute, and formed multidisciplinary team investigative units working with SCF and schools and so on and so forth to put together cases relevant to child sexual abuse issues. And I raised this because in my experience as a 25 years as a law enforcement officer, prior to 1989, and actually 1993 is when the major emphasis occurred, a lot of sheriff's departments and small police agencies would, if you have a complaint of child sexual abuse, that complaint would be handed off to CSD. And a caseworker in a social service kind of a climate would deal with that case, and it would very rarely come to a criminal prosecution. In our environment today, it's very different. If you get a complaint of child sexual abuse, it comes in through the child abuse hotline in our county, Multnomah County. Those cases are taken very seriously, and in the environment of the multidisciplinary team, the law enforcement community looks at the intake sheets from SCF, and they judge whether or not an investigation should or should not be started. And likewise, SCF looks at some of the investigations ongoing with the police. The bottom line is all of these things are now being monitored to a much larger extent than they were previously. The specific responsibility to investigate child sexual abuse was given to law enforcement and not SCF, but they were to work in conjunction with each other. But all of these cases in Multnomah County, and I'm not sure if it's the case all over the state, are all submitted to the district attorney's office for review. Every single case that's taken under an investigation is started, it goes to the DA's office. So there are a significant number of prosecutions that occur now, and I think generally the DA's office looks pretty blindly at who the suspect is. I mean, they do get into some of the discussion about charging and so on and so forth. But I'm just saying all of that to say that there are a lot more cases that are actually going to the DA's office for potential prosecution, and I think that some of this growth that we see in persons going to prison and are registered sex offenders are, in fact, a result of some increased enforcement and prosecution. Okay. Sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. I'll be referring... you have a handout in front of you that's marked Juvenile Sexual Offender Registration. My name is Keith Kaufman. I'm trained as a clinical
psychologist. Could you speak up, please?
Sure. My name is Keith Kaufman. I'm trained as a clinical psychologist, and in my professional background, I spent a number of years working with and assessing victims of sexual abuse, as well as their families, as well as adolescent sexual offenders. And my intent in talking with you today is to give you a little bit of a background with regard to national issues and research issues around registration of juvenile sexual offenders. And it does seem clear that everyone's intent, particularly with regard to registration, is enhancing community safety. There's a growing belief nationally, however, that some of the directions with regard to registration in particular and some other movements are more motivated by focus on a small proportion of very dangerous juvenile offenders in particular, and generalizing those beliefs to the whole population of juveniles who at some time engage in some inappropriate sexual behavior. And in fact, last spring, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention in Washington, D.C. convened an experts meeting to look at issues around the accountability and the treatment of juvenile sexual offenders. And one of the things that they targeted in terms of a concluding theme was that it was important to start to deal with myths around policy decisions with regard specifically to juvenile sexual offenders and the extent to which that small proportion of very dangerous juvenile offenders is influencing the kinds of policies that we're seeing across the country. You'll note in the handout that there's a quote there that suggests that they said that the small number of behaviors classified as serious or violent sexual offenses disproportionately influence the public policy of all juveniles charged with sexual offenses. They go on to make a number of recommendations that I think are germane to the issues that you're dealing with. First, they highlight the importance of differentiating adult and juvenile sexual offenders with regard to assessment, monitoring, and treatment. They also note the importance of recognizing that treatment has been effective with juvenile offenders for the most part, and it's important that treatment continue to be focused on something more than simply the sexual nature of the problems, because most of these juveniles have much more broad-based problems, and to truly address that issue, those other issues need to be addressed. They also suggest the importance of understanding that most risk assessment overpredicts risk. So it's important to understand that where we look at the use of risk assessment, whether it's with adults or with juveniles, the tendency is for those measures to overpredict the risk of a juvenile or adult sex offender. But they also recognize that risk assessment is a key part of the process of monitoring and supervision to maintain community safety. The fourth point that they make is in quotes, and they say that recognizing that registration statutes are often misapplied to sexually offending juveniles, placing children and youth at risk in multiple ways without increasing public safety. And I'll come back to that in just a minute. And finally, they talk about ending the process of labeling all juvenile sexual offenders as lifetime sexual offenders as a critical factor. Now, if we back up for just a minute and look at what are some of the assumptions that led them to those conclusions, I think there are four or five key points. The first is that there's considerable evidence that juvenile sexual offenders do differ from adult offenders. Some of that is in a 50 or 60 or 70-year history of research on developmental differences. One of the things that's really important for us to consider is the fact that juveniles making decisions, inappropriate decisions around sexual abuse or sexually inappropriate behavior, are bringing to that immature cognitive systems, emotional systems, social perspectives. It's also important to consider that juveniles are also in a position where they're different from adult offenders in terms of community supervision and monitoring, in that they have some natural advantages that adults don't have. That may be extended family, it may be caregivers, it may be the schools, it may be community organizations, but clearly there are things that are available for juveniles that aren't for adults. Also need to consider that the research suggests that juvenile offenders are considerably less sexually aggressive and considerably less focused specifically on the sexual aspects other sexual offending. Also, a second point is the fact that juvenile offenders are more responsive to treatment. There's a variety of research studies that support the efficacy of treatment, suggesting that recidivism rates, for juvenile offenders tend to be in the range of 2 to 19%, which tends to be considerably less than adult offenders. When they do reoffend, it also tends to be non-sexual recidivism, which again goes back to the issue of the importance of offering broad-based treatment. What was mentioned earlier was the issues around offender risk assessment, and Karen's correct. Risk assessment in general is in its infancy, and in particular with juveniles, we're just beginning to see work by Robert Prenke, Jim Whirling, and there are a couple of very promising measures that are available that we'd very much like in Oregon to start looking at as a good means of identifying the risk of offenders. Moreover, risk assessment, I think, offers something beyond just issues about making decisions about registration. Risk assessment is an ongoing dynamic means of identifying the kinds of problems that a juvenile might have and what kind of response we need to make sure that those risks don't turn into reoffense. Final point is, and probably most importantly, there is no research support for the assertion that registration improves community safety. There's not one study out there that suggests that. And moreover, there's a growing body of information that suggests that there are unintended consequences to the juvenile. And I'm sure we've all heard about harassment issues, about being suspended from school, harassment of their family. What we don't often think about is that registration, especially registration that's on the internet and affords very easy access, since a large proportion of these cases are familial or intrafamilial, somewhere between 40 and 60%, that identifying a juvenile sexual offender is very often also identifying their victim and putting their victim in the position of being harassed, of being identified as there being something wrong with them. So there are consequences that we need to consider beyond the fact that there's no empirical support. There are adverse effects, not only for the juvenile and their family, but also potentially for victims and their family. So in sum, it seems that based on empirical literature and those and scientific evidence, that there's really little reason to support the efficacy or effectiveness of registration in terms of improving community safety. It would seem that funds would be much better spent focused on improving supervision, on tailoring treatment, and on using some dollars to develop better risk assessment measures that are tailored to juveniles that could really help us make some decisions about what's the best kind of treatment, what's the best kind of supervision, and does a particular juvenile need to be supervised. I think that the proposed model has a lot of merit. I think that the strongest merit associated with the model is the fact that what it does is it ties the juvenile successful completion of treatment to some positive consequence. In other words, you could get off registration, or perhaps if it were looked at another way, you might be able to get off supervision by following through and being successful in treatment, reducing your risk factors. Again, you know, I would hope that would be given strong consideration in terms of making decisions, and that the dollars would be moved in the direction where they do the most benefit. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions? No. All right, we're quickly running out of time. And there are two people in the audience who came from over 100 miles, so I want to go ahead and take their testimony, and then we'll talk about budget issues. First one is Peter, is it Dental? Really? Okay.
Is that big cursive writing?
Big volume. Yeah,
big cursive writing. Yeah.
All right. Sir, you're from Jefferson County.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, let me introduce myself. I'm Peter Duell. I'm the district attorney for Jefferson County, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak today. I'll try and keep my comments appropriately focused and relatively brief. Senator Duncan raised one issue that gave me an image. I grew up in the 50s and 60s in the Medford area in Southern Oregon, and if anybody, I'm sure there's many of you that had traveled I-5 up and down throughout the state, and we used to have those wonderful signs on the border, something about coming to visit but do not stay. I had this vision that we need a sign that says, if you are a convicted sex offender, please register, however. I would like to say, and I'm on behalf, I'm here on behalf of not only my own beliefs and interests as the elected district attorney for Jefferson County, but as a representative of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, as a participant in the work group that's been going on for a number of months now, addressing the very issue that that we're considering today. We'd like to say that essentially the position of the district attorneys, by and large, that that a format that has a presumed registration is favorable, is a favored format, that registration does serve a good public policy interest. We believe there is an element of public safety concern, public right to have information to know of offender conduct, and it also serves a practical and realistic tool for law enforcement in our communities. Presumptive probation, we believe, is a good policy because in my experience as a prosecutor with many juvenile sex offenders, we don't end up knowing a whole lot about their character and conduct early on in our involvement with the prosecution and with the early stages of treatment. It's only after periods of time that we come to understand more clearly on an individual and case-by-case basis what the issues are with a particular offender, a particular youth, and be able to make informed decisions at a more informed and later point of time. Also have gleaned that, as best I can understand, it is not just the conduct of the youth offender during the period of supervised probation, but also, as importantly, how they do for a period of time, at least off of supervised probation, that is very instructive and informative to future risk to the community and propensity and risk to reoffend. Again, another reason that we are supportive of a presumptive registration, I would like to say that the both myself and the District Attorneys Association does recognize the need for a modification and fine-tuning of the registration laws that now exists. We would, and we are supportive of the issue that it needs an adjustment in order to make an informed case-by-case decision and disposition at a meaningful point of time in the youth's progress through the criminal justice system. And also, we believe that it's important that there be a period of time when the youth is no longer on probation to factor that information in. The burden is also an issue of whether whether the format for a youth offender to register should include some automatic provisions or be weighed by some assessment process. It makes sense to have some clear criteria, and it makes sense to have a judicial determination, but the prosecutors generally believe that it would be important to actually have the ability to consider on a case-by-case basis whether or not the youth needed to continue on a registration format, and also believe that that system should involve the burden of the youth being able to come forward in the context of some degree of a hearing with set criteria and make a showing that indeed they have successfully met the terms of the probation, they have successfully changed their conduct, as well as staying out of trouble and crime-free. The work group that I participated in, we've met numerous times. I was trying to recall, and I didn't get an opportunity to go back through my calendar, but at least 6, 8, or maybe 10 different sessions, we addressed a number of these issues about the burden of proof, about the criteria, produced a working draft that I believe Chairman Minnis had received. I don't know whether anybody else has had any information about that working draft. But again, the discussion was going toward a presumptive probation and set in specific criteria to allow the youth to apply for relief. There had been a question earlier about current sex offender laws, and I think Oregon State Police cleared that up. There is statutory provision, if I'm recalling correctly, that in Chapter 181 that controls sex offender registration, that for C felony and lesser offenses, that there is the ability after 10 years off of supervision under the current law to seek relief. And our position is supportive of a similar structure for the juvenile youth, tailored potentially more specifically to the issues that the juvenile brings to the criminal justice system, but of a similar nature to allow a provision for a hearing and for a mechanism in which the youth can seek relief. I would like to say that although public safety and correlation of studies that inform us whether or not registration gives us better public safety or really doesn't impact that is only one part of the discussion that I think as a community in Oregon we need to have. It's to ensure youth accountability. It's to ensure a sense of that accountability and the sense for the general public that in dealing with probably one of the most significant and serious crimes in terms of impact both on the victim of an incredibly lasting nature and on the community for the collateral costs, that not only are decisions being made based on actuarial study and behavioral assessment study through behavioral science, but I have a strong belief that behavioral science can only go so far. There is also a place as we legislate and endeavor in our respective tasks in addressing profound public safety issues and profound issues of criminal offenders, whether they be adult or youth, that the systems we have in place make common sense to the general population. I believe that by and large, in terms of the constituents in my community, and I don't believe there'd be a substantial difference that sex offender registration for youth at an appropriate time and with an appropriate scope does make sense. I would like to highlight just a couple of other issues and then conclude. There's been presented the chart from OYA, which carves out for offender registration the forcible compulsion cases. I would offer to the committee that no doubt there's concern from a common sense standpoint, indeed, about youth who commit actual forcible compulsion. But I'd also tender to the committee and offer for your consideration that there is also practical and common sense concern for the communities in regard to youth of age 12, 13, or 14 who violate and perpetrate crimes against victims of relatively young and tender age. And even in a small county, we have those cases where the non-Measure 11 youth violate 2- and 3- and 4-year-old victims.
Can you come back at some point? Because if this is the short version, I'd kind of like to hear the long version. And I'd also like to have an opportunity to kind of come back at you a little bit.
I'd be happy to do that, Chairman.
Well, yeah, I think what's interesting is you followed Dr. Kaufman's testimony, which is basically we don't need registration, the money should go to other things. You have, for sure, said you want to keep that tool but make it selective. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And we've also heard testimony we don't even have an assessment tool, which apparently the adults have. That's conflicting me. Okay. Finally, is registration a form of supervision? I mean, there's so many things that are happening here in terms of assumptions and challenges in this whole area that for those who've been heavily involved in this issue, that are, you know, it's like a tsunami hitting us. So I don't know. We need, you know what I'm saying? It's just tumbling now for me because I didn't have a chance to talk to Dr. Kaufman. And I hear that, I'm sorry, that just because I know you want to get to the other two witnesses, but there's so much stuff going on here that...
We have someone asked 100 miles away, you said?
Yes.
What?
There's one other person from 100 miles
away. Yeah.
Yeah, I would be happy.
We're going to bring this particular bill back on Thursday. Yeah. And, committee members, any of you available at 5 o'clock today? I'm available. Anybody not available?
I don't think so.
I'm not. Yeah, I got you.
I'm available. I'm here.
I'm not. Let me see. What we'll do is I think we'll recess until 5 o'clock. But the one person who is here from 100 miles away, where are you? What's this person's name? Tim Jensen? Would you want to come up and give us your testimony now or wait until 5 o'clock?
Could they do it?
From Portland? That's not 100 miles away.
No, I'll be here if you want.
All right, here. Recess till 5 o'clock.
You're going to do it here?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.